Nighttime. Moving slowly over a narrow strip of dark water with patches of white light reflected off it and old buildings to the side. Continuing under a low arched stone bridge towards more buildings and lights. Venice, Italy, March 2017. Long barges with cranes on them and bright lights move slowly along the canal. A police boat with flashing lights cruises past. Damien Hirst presents, in association with Park Circus, an Oxford Films production. A big, heavy barge moves slowly along the canal with the police boat. Two men standing on the side of the barge signal by pushing their hands out. Another man pulls plastic sheeting off a large object.
I mean, I suppose we're all looking for a whole true story that makes sense.
Damien Hirst, wearing a black jacket, t-shirt and baseball cap.
But I think what makes you believe in things is not what's there, it's about what's not there. With any story, the gaps between things is where you locate your belief.
The sculpture is lowered.
You know, it's unbelievable to start with, but that makes you believe it.
A school of small fish swimming in black water. In white letters, treasures from the wreck of the unbelievable. The fish swim off and the words fade away. Daytime. Flying over a beach with people scattered around the palm trees and small white fishing boats sitting just offshore. A boat carrying a dozen passengers cruises through clear water. Indian Ocean, East Africa, February 2010.
The expedition began in 2010. We assembled a group of consultants, ecological experts to advise on avoiding damage to the site, and a representative from the host country to safeguard their interests and oversee what happened to anything we found.
A bearded man.
We had spent the summer of 2009 remotely mapping the site from the surface. It was clear from our scans that there was something down there, but there was no clear indication as to what it was. I've been doing this job for nearly 30 years and I wasn't about to jump to any conclusions.
Professor Andrew Lerner, Department of Archaeology, Centre for Maritime Studies, Aberdeen. The speedboat approaches a long, flat research boat with a tall crane on it.
Right, we all here?
Copy.
Yes? Very good. Right, welcome everybody. My name's Andrew, and I'm the project director on this expedition. This gentleman here is Piotr Klimek. He's a maritime archaeologist of extraordinary dive experience. He will be leading the team under the water alongside Bruce, who's going to be in charge of the divers. So, we're going to start by ground-truthing the main anomalies from the geophysics. And as you can see, we have many artifacts spread over a large area with the major groups here, here and here. No sign of a ship, which might indicate the wreck is early and the hull totally disintegrated. But do keep an eye out for any hull structure that we might have missed. Don't forget to record your locations as you work and keep in communication with the surface team.
Dr. Piotr Klimek, Department of Archaeology.
This phase of the expedition is what we call a pre-disturbance survey. And this is mostly to establish really in detail what is and how much of it is down there.
A group of divers put their tanks, flippers and masks on. One jumps in. From under the boat, looking up as more divers jump in. Over the radio, could you give me a sound check? Countdown from five, over. Five, four, three, two, one. I copy, over. Four divers swim down to the seabed. Small tropical fish flit around lightly coloured rocks. They disperse as a diver approaches and swims past, over the rocks and coral. Thin streams of bubbles rising from his head. On the radio, surface support, this is Piotr. Andrew's on the boat.
Yeah, go ahead, Piotr, over.
Piotr says, "Hello, mate. Just a quick update. We're just working across the dive site. I wish you could see this. Over."
"I wish you could see this. Over."
Inland, a local taxi truck drives through the tropical landscape. A man with a shaved head sits in the back looking out. Peter Weiss, Technische Universität Heidelberg.
"It began for me in 2008. I was in the middle of my doctoral thesis. I say in the middle, I hadn't really written anything in a couple of months, and I was running out of funds. And then I discovered the clip on the internet."
April 2008. Video footage of people and fishing boats along the beach.
"I assumed it was posted by a backpacker or a holidaymaker, someone like that. All you could see, a beach, I assumed East African, and a community of fishermen."
People crowd around a boat.
"And the clip was entitled Fisherman Discover Statue. The group of fishermen have pulled something up in the net. It looked like a curled up fetal monkey. To see something come out of the water that you can't quite explain, that's an adventure that you want to know more."
The fishermen untangle the small white statue.
"I thought, if these fishermen found one thing, it stands to reason that there is more down there. So I wanted to find this beach and I wanted to talk to these fishermen."
Peter gets out of the taxi at the beach.
"Yeah, this is the beach. I knew as soon as I saw it, because I've seen it so often on the video. The fishermen said they had been back to look whether there was anything else out there, and they couldn't find anything. So after a lot of negotiation, they took us out to where they said they discovered it."
On a boat, Peter asks, "Do you think we have the right spot?" A man replies, "It's somewhere around here. Let's go down and look."
"Yes, life to farm. Yeah, wonderful. Yep. Yes."
Diddy.
"First day, we go to this island. Is this place? I go in, I dive."
Swimming over the reef.
"I dive for hours to end."
Diddy surfaces.
"Do you find anything?"
"No."
"So that was nothing again?"
"No." "It took us days because it was a blind search."
"Nothing?"
"Nothing here."
"Shit. Patience, yes?"
"Yeah."
"Okay." "We nearly gave up."
Wearing a body cam, Diddy gets into the water again.
"It was on the fifth day. Had my GoPro on, went down, half an hour search."
He swims towards a collection of flat rocks and coral.
"And voila."
A headless statue of a body, facing down, with coral on it.
"Finally."
"This is it."
"Yes?"
"This is the place."
"You sure?"
"Yes. This is awesome."
"Yeah?"
"Yes."
"Yes."
Andrew Lerner.
Peter sent me the footage. It showed what looked like a classical sculpture that had lain on the seabed for a considerable amount of time. We knew that it was worth pursuing, but it was going to be hard to get funding through the usual channels.
BBC News.
Last year, he caused controversy in the modern art world by creating a diamond-encrusted skull.
Une révolution dans le monde de l'art.
Brash and brazen artist Damien Hirst
is putting more than 200 new pieces up for auction.
"Lot number one, $8,200,000. Any more? $8,300,000. Thank you."
Hirst's open mouth shot staggered all expectations.
"So to you, Bruno. $8,500,000.
Now that's a pretty penny for a pretty pickle.
One of the people that we approached was an artist who had just been in the news.
I didn't know much about him. To me, he was the the shark guy.
Damien.
I'd had the auction where I sold all my works in, you know, this three-day big sale. And it really was the point where all the work like became commodity, and it was like, you know, it just seemed like you make something, sell it, make something, sell it, make something, sell it. It seemed unsustainable and unfulfilling.
£9 million and £9 million. Last chance at £9 million. Sold, congratulations.
Some reason after that auction, it seemed like something had ended and something new was beginning.
Old footage.
It's a new era in his exploration of inner space.
I love fantasy shipwreck stories when I was a kid. You know, I just love them.
Within the violent waters that cover this earth comes this story of suspense, chills, terror, excitement beyond compare.
All those old movies about treasures found under the sea.
Somewhere in these waters is a treasure worth a fortune in gold.
I mean, I love the sea because it's an element that's alien to us. It's like, you know, it's like another planet on our own planet.
For the ocean is the last of the Earth's great unexplored frontiers.
To find a major sponsor so soon who had money and an interest, that was amazing. He was basically prepared to take a gamble.
Divers explore the sea floor.
I think everything that I've ever done has been a gamble. But I definitely wasn't tempted to get a wetsuit on because I think the sharks would eat me.
The two divers swim over a thick carpet of vegetation that moves and sways. They reach clear white sand and both point at something up ahead. They swim towards a very small black statue sticking up out of the sand. One of them touches it gingerly. Over the radio, surface support, this is Diver Bruce.
Yeah, this is surface support, go ahead.
I've just located the position. Give me 5 minutes. Andrew stands in the cabin looking out of a window. Underwater, the two divers glance at each other as they swim towards a much larger, dark, blurred object on the white sand.
From the scans, we knew there was a lot down there, but what we discovered was much bigger and more baffling than we'd expected.
They both swim either side of the old stone sculpture, twice the size of them, like an old dinosaur's skull. They touch its curved edges, where coral grows and a single fish with long, extravagant fins swims. One of the divers swims on and finds more pieces of sculpture, all of it absorbed into the coral and seabed. One piece looks like a torso sticking out of the sand, with the head flung back and to the side. A diver swims across a strip of sand to another piece. This one is a short, rectangular block of stone with a carved beak-like shape coming off the side. On the radio, surface support, this is Diver Bruce. Go ahead, Bruce. It's amazing. It's beautiful. Bruce Phillips, dive coordinator.
What's amazing is how it's integrated into the reef. And to actually see the corals and everything that's growing onto it and the fish that are attached to it. But it's still a sculpture. It's like nothing you've ever seen before.
Underwater, Bruce gently brushes one of the sculptures with his hand.
To actually find something that's not been seen for, you know, lifetimes. It's almost like, you know, finding something in its natural habitat. That's what's exciting about the whole project.
Rungwe Kingdon.
Nature is sort of claiming it, but it hasn't claimed all of it yet, so it's like there's the beauty of the nature and there's the beauty of the sculpture side by side. It's in a sort of extraordinary garden. It's like a sort of strange Victorian grotto of the underworld.
A piece with coral growing on it.
It takes lots of years for corals to develop. And you start asking yourself, For how long have these things been down here?
Jesse Veach, diver.
You've just got so many questions coming through your mind of how did they get there? How were they made? Who was it that possibly made them? And what size ships transporting them? Why were they coming through this area? It opens so many questions.
Andrew and Peter watch as the small dive boat returns. Piotr.
The huge pieces just scattered over quite wide area, buried at different angles in the sand. It's no sense really of what happened. There's no sense of accident. Is it a shipwreck? Is it several shipwrecks? It's a mystery. At this stage, it's a mystery.
At the beach, fishing nets are pulled off the small boats in shallow water. Fishermen work on a strip of beach covered in debris from the sea and palm trees. Inland, a woman enters a building called Suleiman Hall and prints some photographs. Professor Gina Bryant, consultant art historian, Boston Archaeological Museum.
Well, these are what we found in the first couple of weeks. We have a fascinating range of artifacts developing, a wide range of dates, provenances. The selection of different styles suggests this could be the contents of a merchant ship. As yet, we don't have anything to pin a specific date down.
On the big dive boat, a thick pipe about a foot wide is moved into position.
Today, we will start working with the airlift. It's basically a device that will vacuum the seabed, takes away the lighter materials, the sand, silt. You know, for the first time in possibly centuries, you know, we're disturbing what's underneath the sand. There could be much more down there.
A diver walks slowly along the sea floor, pulling the pipe behind him. With two more divers walking beside him, he approaches a sculpture half buried in the sand and uses the end of the pipe to start probing around it. The pipe sucks up sand around the sculpture, disturbing bits of old seaweed and coral that rise up in the water. Two divers use their hands to gently brush sand away from a smaller sculpture. On the surface, the crew wait patiently on the boats. The divers methodically continue their work, sand rising around them. One of the divers finds a small coin. Piotr.
I just saw something glinting in the sand. As you work, in the least expected moments, you uncover something that is crucial.
He takes it to the others.
Guys, look at this. What's this? Right?
Okay.
What is it?
It's Roman.
Wow.
It is Roman.
Look at this.
Fantastic.
That's Nero. AD 54 to 68, Roman first century. Looks like you got yourself a date.
We got ourselves a date.
Big moment for us. The picture starts to become much clearer now.
This is great. Exactly the kind of thing we'd hope to find.
The coin dates from the rule of the Emperor Nero, so we know for certain the ship could not have gone down before 54 AD.
And I'm trying to get the important bit up here. Where is it? There it is. It's perfect. And you see him, Nero. So, if we're talking about a shipwreck from between the mid-first and mid-second centuries AD, during this period, there was a Roman market in plunder of earlier classical cities, and a market for artifacts from Egypt.
The divers measure one of the sculptures.
And of course, in the first century navigational guide, the Periplus of the Erythraean Sea, there were records of routes of trade between the Mediterranean world and China in the east.
This document, the Periplus, was key to us. proof of trade and cultural cross-pollination across the first and second centuries. Proof that a merchant could amass such an eclectic collection.
An old map naming Barbaria behind some coastal mountains.
But there were no rich cultural centres nearby where there was any kind of trade in antiques.
The fishermen work on the shore.
What was a cargo as big and valuable as this doing off this stretch of the East African coast?
Some of the younger locals play football on the beach as the sun sets. An aerial view of the large diving boat out at sea. Underwater, a diver's gloved hand picks up a small face mask. Two divers walk along the seabed carrying a plastic crate of finds.
We knew the ship was from the first or second century. And although the ship's woodwork would have disintegrated, we began to uncover what seemed like the personal effects of a ship's crew.
The crew carry the plastic crates from a floating deck onto the main boat.
This is a whole series of plates, bowls. There's quite a lot of diversity here of shapes and forms. Look at that, that looks like a sailor's plate to me. That's a load of coins all accreted together. There's some loose ones here as well. But that would have been probably in a sack. And the whole sack went down and the whole thing's fused together.
A metal bowl.
Nice, isn't it?
The cook stirs a pot in the galley and tastes it. Piotr walks across the deck, carrying a bent metal bar. He passes to other crew.
Hello, guys.
And then we found something else.
Where is Angel? The bar.
It was a huge surprise. And a huge clue.
My God.
It's several feet long.
This is a bolt that would have been used in the keel of a ship, the first or second century AD. And this is truly enormous for something of this kind. I've only ever seen a few examples from this era, but the biggest I've seen have been from a Roman wreck from the French coast at La Madrague de Giam. And that ship was big, but this is much bigger, and it's broken at the end. You know, it's sheared off. So who knows what the actual size would have been?
The archaeology department at the University of Southampton.
This one bolt meant that we could, with the help of our colleagues from Southampton University, spend the whole winter recreating how the boat might have been built and what it might have looked like.
One of the biggest vessels that we have to compare it to is from south of France, Madrid de Gien. Mm-hmm. And this is a cross-section through the bottom of that vessel.
That's the bolt.
That's the bolt running right the way down there. And the one from your site is way, way bigger. So it's got to be coming off a much, much bigger ship. So we went through to some of the really standard iconography from the ancient world that gives us this idea of the recurved bows. That's consistent with the Madrague, and it's what they seem to be using on these really, really big merchant ships. What we got to with doing that was this.
So what are we talking lengthwise, do you think?
60 metres.
60 metres.
60 metres seemed like a...
50% bigger.
So, yeah. So really, really big. And we know vessels that big could have existed. Mm. You know, it's not outside the realms of the engineering capabilities that they had. You know, quite a lot of crew on this boat. A lot of big, heavy mast sails. I thought we'd go a little bit further and start to look at the actual vessel sailing along. So we've just taken our basic reconstruction and we've given it the sort of CGI treatment, if you like.
Hollywood treatment.
Yeah. And there it is sailing along. And you get a real idea of the scale of the thing.
Sitting
even
at
the guy just out on the flying gallery at the front.
Quite simply, we were looking at an enormous ship. We knew the ship was from, probably from the first or second century. And so we knew that we were looking at by far the largest ship from that period to ever have been identified.
Peter sits in a dark room going through microfilm.
I was looking for records of an extraordinarily large ship.
His eyes dart as he looks at old written documents.
Even though import and export duties would have been levied and recorded, very little survives. Shipping records for the East African coast during the first and second centuries after Christ are virtually non-existent. There was nothing that helped me identify it.
In a library.
So I started looking into eyewitness accounts that would have recorded a monumental ship.
Peter walks amongst the narrow bookshelves.
The great Roman chroniclers like Tacitus or Pliny the Elder mentioned nothing. Neither did the more obscure diarists. So I moved on to tales of legend. And that's how I discovered the story of Aulus Calidius Amortan.
A Roman mural underwater. Peter Weiss.
As the legend goes, Amortan was a man freed from slavery. And he developed this love of beautiful things and amassed this huge collection of treasures. He planned to build a monumental palace or a temple to house them all. And he built the Apistos, the largest ship known to man, to transport them all. On this great voyage to the temple, the ship was struck by a storm or attacked by a giant sea monster, depending on what version of the story you read, and lost forever.
Dr. Lisa Howe, Faculty of Classics.
In the first century AD, one of the really popular genres of literature was collections of marvels, collections of interesting things that were said to have happened. But how many of these texts tell the truth, and the absolute truth is a very big question. I would say it's naive to take the story entirely at face value, but I wouldn't say it's naive to think that there is a kernel of truth in it somewhere. But how many pieces of art he had, what it was that he had, how far he sailed, why he sailed out, and all of that is the stuff that will have been legendized in the telling.
An old American newsreel.
Now to the Mediterranean. Legend tells of an eccentric collector's enormous ship and his worldly possessions lost at sea. Captain George Knowles has made it his life's work to find the treasure.
He swims underwater.
I think it's a very human thing to romanticize the story of Amortan. I suppose your common sense would tell you this is just made up, this is just a story, but then if you actually find proof of it, it becomes that much more remarkable because it's actually true.
The diver finds some treasure.
One or two of the more credulous treasure hunters of the 20th century took this obscure legend seriously.
I come from a background where we must have proof and we must have evidence. Ours is a hunt for knowledge and not treasure.
Any firm details about where the wreck may lie have been lost in the sands of time.
I started to believe that the wreck had not been found, not because it was a myth, but because people were looking in the wrong place.
Captain Knowles swears he will leave no stone unturned until he has found the lost treasure.
Peter's romanticism, I think, sometimes got the better of him.
The long red diving boat and pontoon deck sits on a calm sea. March 2011. Several divers jump off into the sea.
Morning, morning, Bruce.
And in.
Back. Yep, we're back this year for another 6 weeks. This is as long as we can dive for before the weather changes.
And the plan is to look at some of the bigger pieces and hopefully bring them up.
Over the radio, Peter, divers standing by for the crane over. Underwater, the divers attach straps to a sculpture.
This is it.
The two divers stay with the large sculpture and hold onto the straps as it starts to move across the sand. Over the radio, quick update. I'll just get the final confirmation and I'll give you the go-ahead to start lifting, over. Bruce standing by. The divers hold on to the white sculpture as it begins to rise. Over the radio, you can go ahead and start lifting to the surface, over. Copy that. We're ready to lift now. Over. The metal pulley of the crane breaks the surface. The winch turns, and the crew watch anxiously. The divers and sculpture rise up through the murky water. The sculpture white like a large, elongated skull in the gloom. It carries on towards the sunlight reflecting off the water above. Over the radio, all right, she's about to break the surface.
All right, she's about to break the surface.
So I want to see this.
Okay, so I can see it. Down there. Oh my goodness, look at that.
The mottled, white, skull-like sculpture lifts clear of the water.
Fantastic.
Look at that. You can see its teeth.
It's lifted up high and moved across to the deck. Its shape similar to an elephant's skull, with the end of its tusks fused together.
What you're looking at is the skull of an elephant or great mammoth. It looks like it's man-made, carved out of marble. When the Greeks and Romans discovered fossil remains, they informed their popular beliefs. And it used to be thought, with skulls like this, with the large single cavity in the center of the face, that these gave birth to, or at least justification to the existence of cyclops and mythological tales. I think it's an incredibly detailed example of the power of mythology.
Damien.
One thing that excited me about the project is how you inhabit the past, and it's like it's unknowable, really. But little glimpses and fragments of objects and stories, that's what makes you kind of know the past.
Another sculpture is prepared.
All right, diver Bruce, over.
On the radio, let me know when you're ready for lifting, over. Copy, ready to lift now, over.
History's always been rewritten and rewritten. You know, the solidity that we call history is written from fragments.
Amazing, look at him, that raised spine.
A slim, headless figure standing on a platform is lifted out.
Wow, look, you can see how he's oxidized under there. He's been there for some time, it looks like.
Gina examines it closely.
Human features with bestial traits. Characteristic of the Mesopotamian demon. The question is, could this be the so-called Pazuzu demon?
Professor Joost Aldenberg.
In the 1920s, British archaeologists were digging in the upper Tigris Valley of Mesopotamia. They discovered a small settlement along the banks of the river. And among their finds was thought, by some, to be a head of the Babylonian demon king, Pazuzu.
Gina.
Stylistically, they both seem to be of a piece.
I remember when I first saw the demon, I was asking myself, why am I believing it? Am I believing it because it's got these missing parts? You believe it because it's, you know, in a history of it travelling through time, through thousands of years, it's bound to have, you know, had accidents and mishaps. And I love the way that time can age it and deteriorate it. It's like the action of the world on this object. You realise that everything in the world is going to become fragments. And then you realise that that's really where belief lies, is between fragments.
We thought he was, you know, lost forever, and this could be him, and he's beautiful.
What makes you believe in things is not what's there, it's about what's not there.
They clean the statue with water from a hose. A diver swims above the sand, carrying a dark object attached to a cable. Two more divers gently brush sand away from a large sculpture lying on the seabed. They lift up an irregularly shaped sculpture.
A cyclops, demons, unicorns. It did tell us a little bit about Amotan's character.
A diver's lifted towards the surface with the strange black sculpture. Three dogs' heads coming off one body. It's brought up out of the water.
I think he genuinely believed in monsters, he believed in cyclopses, he believed in unicorns, you know, I mean, I just think he was that type of a person. And I guess if you believe in them in the beginning, then you create things to justify their existence.
Underwater, another irregular-shaped sculpture is stood upright on the seabed. A large sculpture like a lion, with coral growing over its mane, is pulled up towards the surface by the ship's crane. All of the objects are mottled with age and have colourful coral growing on them.
Whether it was this Amotan that Peter's talking about or whether it's somebody else, these are not objects that are just randomly chosen.
Divers swim down to a statue of two people.
I'm not prepared to say it is Amotan, but for my money, there's certainly somebody with a vision and with a dream, a massive dream, and a pretty big ego behind all of this.
The plain statue of a woman with the arms missing from the shoulder and the head broken off at the top of the neck.
I can't see this as a trading vessel. There are very definite aesthetic choices being made here. I think if it was trade stuff, you'd see multiples of similar things. This seems to be more coordinated.
A large, bulky object is taken up to the surface in a rope net. A boat travels down a wide canal in Venice, moving slowly past a domed church.
Obviously, Amotan had an idea of an audience, and then his dreams were scuppered when the boat sank. But now these objects have come back up again. I wanted to find a great place to exhibit them.
Damien sits in a boat, looking up thoughtfully at the buildings.
The Venetians amassed collections and brought things from far reaches of the world. You know, when you look at the four horses in St. Mark's, and you realise that they're a massive symbol of Venice, and so is the lion. But they came from faraway lands. They weren't really a symbol of Venice, they were plundered. The lion came from Athens, and the four horses came from Constantinople. The history of where they came from is lost, and they become totally synonymous with Venice.
The boat takes Damien across a wide stretch of water towards more historic buildings. Back on the diving boat in the Indian Ocean, some crew members catch small fish and drop them into a green bucket. Over the radio, surface support, this is Diver 2, Piotr.
Yeah, it's Andrew, Diver 2, go ahead, over.
You won't believe what we've got down here. I'm coming up. Andrew and Peter walk across the deck and meet Piotr.
Well, let's go to the office.
They go inside and Piotra says, Andrew, can you close the door? We've got a little bit of a problem. We've found quite a lot of gold. That's great news, isn't it? Yes, but it will undermine our security here. Two divers swim together across the ocean floor.
We drifted in a strong current over quite a wide area. Over sea grasses, over big lumps of coral. And then we found scattered, half-buried gold objects.
Small pieces of gold lying in the sand.
So on one hand, I was thinking, my God, this is possibly the greatest moment of my career. But on the other hand, panic set in.
The gold is scattered all around them.
Because this stuff is worth millions.
Some of the half-buried items look quite large.
Yeah, I mean, to find this much gold is thrilling, but for an archaeologist, it's a big problem. Your gut instinct is to bring up something valuable, but we can't do that.
Roughly how long will it take us to get it up? Well, we have only seen a fraction of it. I say bring it up. No, we can't bring it up, because then we lose the advantage of being able to see it in situ.
My solution is simple. I mean, you bring this stuff up as soon as you can.
The reason I sought the money for this is to find what could be a treasure. This expedition is not about treasure. I'm just saying bring it up now. That way it's safe. We know where it is. You're missing the point. You're missing the point.
We know where it is.
You're missing the point. You're missing the point.
Moving slowly over gold artifacts lying in the sand. The more time goes by, the more people will know. We want to be able to study why it's sitting there, where it's sitting, how the marine life has grown around it. This is how you work on an archaeological... I get that. But what time frame are you looking at?
Let's say 7 days minimum.
We increase the security quietly. I just think you're naive in thinking you can keep this quiet for 7 days. Peter, you need to trust our judgment on this, okay? Andrew addresses the crew on deck.
Now, I know we're all really excited, but, you know, this goes without saying. Those confidentiality agreements that you signed, they're serious, okay? No photos, absolutely nothing posted on the internet. Or any bloody tweets or anything like that.
A diver jumps into the water. They sketch some of the items lying in the sand. Others are measured. Piotra.
The chances are that once the truth is out, it will just generate all sorts of interest, you know, from treasure hunters, from pirates, from all sorts.
Really, what I want to be able to do is to just double the security for the, you know, the remaining week.
A diver sketches gold snakes. A crewman calls to the small boat. You need to fish way over there. We have divers here. We're diving here. You need to go over there, please. On land, a villager says, they have a ship, but I don't know what is going on. The people go there and they come back. Another says, a lot of the villagers, they thought that maybe they searched for something like gasoline, petrol. The first one says, they make research for fish, maybe. The fishermen go about their work on the beach. The second villager says, some friends told me that they see a big sculpture, like a woman. They see it down on the sea there.
Like a woman, they sit down on the sea there.
Bruce Phillips addresses the crew on the boat.
What I'd like to do is just give a briefing on what we want to achieve this morning.
Ready?
We're going to load the pucker up first, and we're going to put all the lift bags, all the ropes, and the gear for most of the divers onto the pucker, and we're going to send it out. Okay. Any questions on that? So today's big day. We've decided, after much deliberation, to bring the gold items up.
A diver clears sand from around some gold. On the radio, expected time of arrival 10 to 15 minutes from now, over.
Okay, over and out.
The gold item, like a small nest of snakes, is attached to an airbag and lifted up towards the surface. The crew watch the water tensely. The diver and red airbag come into view beneath the surface. Viewed from below, the gold snakes are silhouetted against the sunlight. The diver hands it up. The nest of snakes is put on the deck.
Fantastic!
It's a small Medusa head.
How big is that?
What do you think of that?
Peter carries it away.
I don't think anyone could ever imagine that something like this would happen to them. You dream about it, but do you honestly believe that it will? Probably not.
It's going straight into the water?
Yep.
I mean, the amazing thing about the gold works that were found is that gold doesn't tarnish, so they're totally timeless. It's shiny and it sort of dances in your eyes. You see it in movies. The guy opens the case and this gold shines on their faces.
Peter and the crew grin as they look down into the water. A diver uncovers more gold.
There are so many objects made of gold. I mean, his collector, he was obviously obsessed with it as a material. Gold makes people do crazy things, you know, it's like it has done for years. You know, there's a lot of blood associated with gold. You know, gold can drive people mad. I mean, who's to say what makes it like that? Is it its rarity, its scarcity, or is it, you know, is it something, you know, naturally inside the metal itself?
Fantastic. Unbelievable. Got it?
Andrew carries the small gold statue of an elephant in both hands. On the seabed, a gold cat is lifted up off the sand and stood upright. A diver swims up to the surface with it and hands it up onto the deck. The statue looks clean and flawless. Nicholas Kanumba, Associate Director, Centre for Underwater Heritage, carefully carries it away.
I can't believe these things.
He puts it in water.
It is truly beautiful.
It lies next to the Medusa. Nicholas looks down at them and nods. The clear water ripples, making the open-mouthed Medusa's face move. Nighttime on the boat.
It's interesting that the gold was found on its own. I think that indicates to me that maybe they tried to escape with the gold. You know, the ship was definitely going down. It was irreparably damaged. And they thought the gold was worth the risk of putting in a smaller boat and trying to escape with.
Peter.
If you rely on myth, if you rely on legend, people tend to not take you very seriously. But this vast amount of gold suddenly made my story come to life. At this point, I was prepared to go out on a limb by saying that what we had found was indeed Amotan's treasure.
In Venice, a row of docked gondolas bob on the water. Two white passenger boats motor past an impressive square white building with a large black statue in front of it. Inside, moving slowly up a stone staircase towards a white statue set against a turquoise blue background. In a long room, the gold items are exhibited in individual glass cases. The Medusa's head on its side, mouth open, the snakes with their heads up. A statue of a young, slim woman from the top of the thighs upwards, the soft contours of her stomach and bare breasts, her long braided hair hanging down over each shoulder and tied up in a topknot. The young, pretty face of another woman, her voluminous hair tied back in a scarf. The engraved elephant, standing strong on all fours, with its trunk curled up in the air and pointing outwards. Next to it, the cat, sitting upright and proud. Close up, a monkey on its haunches, holding a cob of corn in one hand and scratching its head with the other. Another close-up of intricate engravings, the quarter moon and clusters of stars set onto small raised circles that surround an open eye with letters engraved around it. Back in East Africa, the wind blows through the palm trees. Andrew prints a photo in Suleiman Hall.
Today, one of the divers uncovered a huge golden disc. And it was found in an area where we found many of the other gold items, but it was completely covered with silt. And obviously there's pressure now to bring it up as soon as possible.
Underwater, two divers attach the winching straps to a large object, but sand billows around them. On the radio, surface support, diver two go ahead, over. We are struggling with the current down here. On the surface, a wave washes under a buoy. Peter Cleave, deck operations manager.
Andy, the weather's picked up a bit.
Right.
We weren't expecting any wind today. It's just picked up.
How long is it going to be before we know?
Well, we'll just take it hour by hour and see what the weather does.
The sea darkens and swells around the boat.
I've stopped all operations.
That's a very good move.
We'll postpone till tomorrow. Hopefully the weather.
On land, wind blows through the palm trees. Locals take shelter or carry umbrellas.
We left a minimal crew on the boat for now, just to keep it safe. And we're waiting for the weather to clear. It's not looking like it's clearing, is it?
Lightning flashes in the thick grey clouds. Peter.
It's important that we lift the gold disc as soon as possible. To me, it's the clearest indication yet that we have found Amutan's treasures.
Peter plays cards on his own. The storm continues. An old painting underwater.
In later versions of the Amutan myth, the hero gets visited by the goddess Artemis, who instructs him to build a temple to the sun god Apollo, and that becomes his motivation to collect the great treasures of the old world.
This story was told after Christianity took hold and can be read as a warning against embracing the old pagan gods, with Amutan punished for worshipping false idols. Gods going back to the earliest civilizations.
Must have been a night like this that it all ended for Amutan. Imagine the Apistos loaded with Amutan's collection coming up against a storm like this.
Forks of white lightning flash down from the clouds. White swelling waves crash into shore. The sun rises in a cloudy sky over a calm sea. Underwater, sand clears away from a gold face lying on the seabed with its eyes closed. Peter stands on shore and looks out to sea.
The sun is back. The sun god Apollo is with us.
A diver drops into the water. On the seabed, a large gold disc several feet across, with the protruding face in the center, is lifted up. On the surface, the disc is held upright with the bottom half still in the water, light reflecting off the subdued face.
I believe what we're lifting today isn't just a gold disc. It's evidence of solar worship. An image of the sun, a sun disc.
Everyone watches eagerly as the crane lifts it clear of the water, the disc dark and the face light. Nicholas Kanumba.
Sun disc has been used by many civilizations and cultures to venerate the god of the sun by literally reflecting his rays. The Egyptians and Incas used them, the Japanese and the Celts. The ancient Egyptians believed the sun's daily pattern of regeneration suggested their own rising after death. This was symbolic of the sun's power to give life or to take away.
The disc is lowered onto the deck and Peter hoses it down.
I think that this sun disc is the centerpiece for Amutan's temple to the sun god Apollo. And the other items that we found, they were to fill the temple.
Close up, bright light reflects off the tip of its nose. The disc stands at the end of the long museum room, its surface polished and smooth, the protruding face slightly mottled. Muted lights illuminate many other artifacts recovered from the seabed. In a bare brick room, shelves display large nuggets of gold of different shapes and sizes. In the centre, two mounted statues still covered in colourful dried coral, both of figures walking with lions. A close-up of a white face with jade-green eyes and dark pupils. The tip of the nose broken off, the lips slightly parted, and the bottom one chipped. From further back, the face and neck are thin, the head bulbous towards the top, and the shoulders narrow. Two elephant skulls sitting on blocks, one white and the other mottled stone. The top half of a bare-breasted woman mounted on the wall facing forward, her hair falling down her back. A brown stone statue of a thin woman, her head tilted slightly upwards towards the sky, her eyes closed. She wears a large headdress, and light-coloured patterns of coral cover her face and one eye. Another statue, standing alone, a serene, sad face of green stone with small dots of coral all over it. A polished grey face, mottled with black marks and with white shells still stuck to it. The eyes are closed and the headdress decorated with small golden stripes. At the front, a cobra's head and a bird's head looking forwards. In East Africa, locals play football on the beach at sunset. Andrew briefs the crew.
Welcome, everyone. The good news is, with just a few more things to bring up tomorrow, we have retrieved 82 items. The bad news is, it seems there's nothing else down there, so our work here's over.
Well, what about the drop-off?
Yes, we have a drop-off here. The depth drops down to 60 to 100 metres.
So, legend has it that there were 100 objects in the boat. Because we've got 15 or so missing, perhaps we should look there?
You know, the side scan didn't pick anything up.
Well, perhaps we didn't scan further enough into the drop-off.
Yeah, I mean, we know that ship is driven from the deep water onto the reef because of the way that the cargo spilled out. I'm really happy. I mean, Peter, you should be very happy.
I am. It just feels like the end is missing. To go home now, knowing that there is an area that I haven't looked at, it doesn't sit right. We've got two more days.
Yes, we've got two more days, but, you know, we've got an awful lot to do. I don't really want to start investigating another area when, you know...
Well, it's not another area, it's the drop-off. We know where it is.
OK. Peter would like us to explore further into the drop-off, which we have scanned. We didn't find anything.
If we're not coming back, shouldn't we make sure that we've checked everywhere?
daytime. From beneath the surface, a scanner is dropped into the water with a cable trailing behind it.
We're just going to have one last look in the deep drop-off. I know that this is a long shot, you know.
A yellow cable slowly drops over the side as the scanner sinks deeper. It sends back a black and white image.
Okay, here we go. How deep are we?
60.
60 meters.
We're at 60 now. So we're moving north. Loads of marine snow. Just give it a minute.
Sorry, guys, this is it's far from great, but this is all we could get, really.
It lights up the sea floor.
Okay, so nothing. So I'm trying to make a loop and sort of go back.
Out on deck, the salvaged items are boxed up in large wooden crates, which the crew put together. In the cabin, the group leaders watch a monitor closely as the scanner moves over the seabed.
What are these things?
It's pretty much just broken coral.
This is stuck or coral.
Oh,
something, wasn't it?
That is
you
something.
Saw something?
Yes. Look.
Hang on.
I can't see it.
Shit.
Yes.
Oh,
yeah,
yes.
We've got something.
Wait.
Where's that?
Oh, come on. Can you go back to where we were?
Okay.
He's trying.
The distorted black and white image clears again.
That was definitely a figure.
You sure?
Yes, absolutely. Oh, God, this thing.
A puff of sand rises up.
What is that?
Jesus, that is part of the figure.
There it is. Look at that.
This is two figures.
The figures distort in the black and white watery image.
So we're coming back next year, I guess.
Well.
Wow.
Peter smiles and shakes his head. Underwater, looking up from the depths at a large school of fish as they swim in unison. Bright light beyond the surface.
The first thing that came to me was the title. Treasures from the Wreck of the Unbelievable.
Behind the fish, a dark statue standing on the seabed.
I started thinking of it as a sort of statement, so it's like Treasures from the Wreck of the Unbelievable, like a kind of something inside your mind. Like the unbelievable was a place in your mind.
Two strange figures in the murky water. Three lights approach behind them, then the lights become one bright white light. Daytime. A sign for White Hart Lane, London, England. Damien.
You know, years ago when I was a student, I was living in a squat in White Hart Lane with some mates. In my bedroom, I could hear a guy who lived next door, and I could hear him through the wall. And then I stopped hearing him. I mean, we thought maybe something had happened. And then after I didn't hear him for about a week, I got my friends and I said, look, come on, let's go and have a look. So we kicked both doors down and then went in there. We actually went in, first of all, because we thought maybe he'd died.
Home video footage going up a narrow staircase, water dripping into a bowl, a small, very cluttered room.
It was like the whole room was just filled with stuff and there was nobody in there. I found out later he was called Mr. Barnes, but at the time I didn't know what he was called. He was one of those guys that went round like with a shopping trolley and bags and he'd collect things, he didn't bring them back, so he was like a hoarder. The rooms were piled high with stuff and I went to the top of these piles and I excavated through the piles and I found like every toothpaste tube he'd ever used, money wrapped up in bags, you know, lots of magazines from like the 40s and the 20s. It was like a whole bag of 50p's and then a bag of 2p's. He had a collection of like clocks. He sort of converted them, painted them, mended them. It was like 60 years of existence in one space.
Every inch is filled up.
I don't know, something about this man that I got to know.
Untidy stacks of paper on shelves.
Going through the time, there were like layers of, you know, geography going through them. But when we got to the table, I found a normal man. And he'd just put objects on a table and put objects on a table until he'd kind of lost his mind or lost touch with civilization and then created this huge collection. I mean, in a way, it becomes an infatuation when you discover something like this. And you try and get inside the mind of somebody who no longer exists.
To the museum in Venice.
You start to go on this journey and then you kind of get lost in it.
A display model of a ship.
With any story, I think you get interested in, you know, the characters.
One side of the ship has been removed to reveal the statues stored in the hold.
You know, I'm a collector and I'm an artist. I understand all those things about money and collecting and, you know, the kind of addiction of it.
A man stands on the flying gallery.
Looking at Amatan through his collection and through his objects. He was a collector like today's collectors are. I think that he begged and borrowed and commissioned and stole to amass this collection.
All the small jade and white statues viewed through the side of the model boat. February 2012. Andrew addresses the crew on the dive boat.
Welcome, everybody. We're going to be diving a little bit deeper this year. We're going to be diving down to 60 metres, so all the usual procedures will apply. And we have a new diver this year. His name's Peter. We are going to do this as an assisted dive. OK, let's hit that drop-off.
Four divers jump into the water. They sink vertically upright down through the darkness, small white dots of light on their heads. They look around, kicking their finned feet, the water slowing their movements down. Long streams of bubbles come out of their breathing apparatus and float up towards the surface. The divers sink deeper and deeper. Dark shapes with small white lights in the murky depths of the Indian Ocean. Peter.
Diving to this depth for the first time is strange enough.
The four of them swim in a group and approach the huge spindly silhouette of a sculpture, the stone of its skin like a reptile's.
These figures, like they've always been there.
The divers swim over it.
And because you can float around them at any height, you sort of forget how big they actually are.
The divers move slowly over the dark, eerie sculpture, parts of its body thick like rock, the other parts thin and spindly like branches on a tree. The divers' bright white lights turn the statues into silhouettes.
You know, I like the fact that Amatan was kind of nuts on the scale of what he tried to do. He seems kind of arrogant in lots of ways, and then he seems foolish in lots of other ways. But above it all, he seems driven to amass this collection.
On the boat, oxygen tanks are checked. Some of the divers suit up and jump in. Andrew's in his cabin.
So we've identified three, perhaps four, sculptures in deep water. Because of their depth and because of the size, we really want to bring them up as soon as we can.
Andrew walks across the large deck.
You know, this piece we estimate to weigh up to upwards of 30 tonnes. We've already had a few divers down to have a scout to see, you know, how we might lift it.
Underwater, looking up at the sculptures.
The idea is to have that as your main lifting point.
Yeah. Divers explore the base of the sculptures and prepare the straps.
Then you have secondary lifting points to this.
The divers carefully put straps around parts of the statue and tighten them with a ratchet. Another diver ties a knot in a thick rope.
There's been a huge amount of planning in this because we don't even know how fragile it is. I mean, just the scale of it and the fact that it survived this long potentially means it must be a very fine casting.
The divers check the lifting ropes are secure. Sand billows up around one of them as he runs his fingers along a strap. The sculpture slowly fades behind the sand.
Everything in place? I hope so. A bit worried, a bit nervous. Well, the worst case scenario is that we've underestimated the weight of us and it pulls the crane over.
Large yellow airbags are inflated, with streams of bubbles rising up around them. Divers stand on the bottom and hold the straps. The statue slowly begins to move, and its large base plate lifts off the floor.
This is just a worrying moment as the crane takes over from the lift bags.
He tells the crane operator, bring the boom closer to the barge. The yellow lift bags reach the surface.
The crane's doing more work than the lift bags now. I feel the barge listing slightly.
Underwater, looking up at the sculpture's five snakes spread out like branches, Andrew.
Do I think the enormous ship of legend
existed? It's completely impossible to say whether this ship that ended up here was the Apostos. It certainly chimes with the legend, and it would have been similar in scale to the legend, but we'll never know.
The black metallic sculpture is lifted out of the water. A hydra, like an old burnt tree with gnarled twisted snakes coming off of its main trunk. Peter.
I know that not all the pieces of the puzzle are here. I'm very aware of that. But I think we have enough pieces of the puzzle to support a story.
Underwater, a diver looks up at a huge statue with stick-like coral growing over its fat body and big, smiling face. The statue rises up, thick crossed legs with colourful coral growing all over them.
When you think about the whole story, it's unbelievable to start with. But most things from history do seem very hard to believe. You know, you look at the Venus de Milo and look at the way the arms are cut off on it and you think somebody must have done that on purpose.
The Hydra sculpture is hosed down on the ship. In Venice, a gondolier with his passengers. Motorboats move up and down a wider canal leading to open water. Inside the museum, moving through pillars that surround a huge bronze statue of a headless man, which rises up two floors towards the glass ceiling. From above, looking down at the man's open hand holding a broken bowl. All over the smooth surface are the coral and growths that have become part of the statue, thin, worm-like strands and thick, mossy clumps. On his shoulders stand two small tree-like growths. In a large, bare room, two statues of humans taking on the Hydra. Both the humans and the Hydras stand on long rocky base plates. One sculpture's surface is smooth, the other is disfigured with centuries of colourful coral, small lines and little plant-like growths all over them. In another room, five small statues are presented on black plinths. One is the supple upper body of a young woman with her arms raised, the moulded metal smooth, the tendons on her neck clear. Standing alone in a corner, a statue of almost pure coral. The figure like a woman's with her hips pushed out to one side, one hand held up and out. On the floor in front of a narrow arched window, three headless and armless female statues, one covered in coral, one pure white and one darker. On the wall to the side, a shelf holding similar plain statues of different sizes. Close-ups of coral covering a sculpture. The reptilian skin of a snake's head with its mouth open and fangs bared. A wolf with its mouth open, small coral plants growing out of its head. Moving slowly up the length of a thin stone face with large blunted teeth, a big nose and small unkind eyes. Next, a pair of jade hands mounted on a plinth, held together as if in prayer, and covered in patches of white coral, patterned like thin lace. In another room, a Buddha-like figure sits cross-legged on a plinth in a glass display cabinet. At the end of another room, the bronze bust of a woman's head, with her hair tied up in a scarf. Before it, lying on its side on a plinth, the half-curled-up, flat gold skeleton of a little monkey. In a large hallway, a vast, tall sculpture of a bear standing on its hind legs, covered in blotches of red and white coral. A warrior stands on its head, with his arms raised aloft victoriously, a sword in each hand. Close-ups of the different corals on the sculptures, some like shells and small plants, others like leaves, others like mosses and fungi that have grown over the centuries and become part of the statue. At the end of a room in front of a brick wall, a large statue covered in coral of a figure sitting cross-legged. Moving around more statues in the room, slowly past the plant-like growths of coral on the back of one, sitting amongst the clumps of small tree-like plants, a figure with its arms around its raised knees and its head bowed. Moving further round, a glimpse of a statue's head, eyes closed, mouth open, and brow furrowed in misery or pain. A small head lies on its side on a rock. A naked baby lies on its back, arms and legs in the air, face creased as it cries. From above, a statue of a bald man, covered in colourful tree-like coral, screaming as he holds the arm and leg of a decapitated smaller man. He stands on a mound of rocks that are also covered in coral, like thick gorse bush. Looking up at the huge bronze statue of a man in the main hall. Exhibition opening, Palazzo Grassi, 8th of April 2017. Visitors stand on the ground floor.
For me, the whole exhibition was about belief.
Visitors look up at the giant statue, taking photographs of it and absorbing it.
Belief in the past. Belief in God. Belief in gods.
They examine items in glass cases.
Or not believing.
Several visitors look at the torso and head of the pharaoh with coral on it. Others look at the white statue of the woman with narrow shoulders.
And belief is a strange thing because there's no absolute truth. Artists don't have the answers, and science doesn't have the answers, and religion doesn't have the answers.
The top half of a bald man pinned to the wall with coral down one side of his face and shoulder.
But somehow collectively, we create some kind of a truth. And whether you believe in anything or not, I think we need something.
Moving slowly across the coral underwater to a small statue with big round ears and a long pointed nose, Mickey Mouse. Directed by Sam Hopkinson. Producer Nicholas Kent. Director of Photography Tim Cragg. Film Editor Peter Norrie. Composer Anne Nikitin. Line producers Marissa Oeftemeyer-Stroger, Rachel Shaddick. Executive producer for Science, Jude Tyrrell. Co-producer for Science, Amy Corrie. Executive producers for Oxford Films, Mark Bentley, Annabelle Lee. Executive producers for Park Circus, John Letham, Nick Varley, Matthew Wells. Featuring in order of appearance, Damien Hirst, Andrew Whipp, Peter Stark, Lachelle Carl, Nicholas Beveny, Piotr Bauman. Bruce Phillips, Akhti Didi Naeem, Rungwe Kingdon, Dr. Julian Whitewright, Dr. Lisa Howe, William Brand, Oliver Plain. East African location crew. Underwater photography, Roberto Rinaldi. Production designer, Greg Shaw. First assistant director, Dan Mumford. Second assistant director, Jenny Farver. Location producers, Kate Bullions, Clay Lucas. Camera assistant, Stephen Donnelly. DIT, Keir Campbell-Byatt. Underwater camera assistant, Marco Panico. Sound recordists, Jonathan Thomas, Adam Prescott. Drone operators, John Four, Anna Vessels. Dive coordinators, Bruce Phillips, Janet Phillips. Underwater stills photographer, Christoph Gierig. Stills photographer, Steve Russell. Casting, Hancock Stevenson Casting. Assistant to Damien Hirst, Sylvia Park. Visual effects, Gareth Parry. Sound designer, Alastair Circuit. Score supervisor, Amanda Street and Nicola Fletcher. Music score provided by Anne Nikitin and DNA Music Limited. Oxford Films. Copyright Damien Hirst Limited. All rights reserved, 2017.